we are back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell, of course, is here with me. We are in San Francisco, and Dr. Walter Truitt Anderson is our guest. No kidding. When I was a little kid, what I always asked for birthdays and for Christmas was stories. And I didn't even say books. I really wanted the stories. So if you will, indulge me and go back to how central stories seem to be. And there are new ways to use that that you're deeply involved with, aren't there?
Yeah, I think as you talk about language and as you talk about the way the human brain seems to work, well, it seems to work in what we might call stories. I mean, that's not the only way that our cognitive processes operate, but a lot of it is kind of once upon a time, this happened and then that happened. And
well, and we've been doing that around fires and things for some time,
right.
Haven't we?
And little stories run through our lives all the time. You know, if you follow if you read the sports pages, as I do, you follow your team, you read the stories about this or that athlete, everybody, you know, in the kind of pop culture follows the stories of the pop stars and who's marrying whom, and you follow the stories of your family, and you follow the stories in the news, and those are all stories, and they all kind of spin through our lives all the time. I mean, we're all
beginning,
the time,
middle, and end.
We're all the
what
time
happened?
Telling stories, mm-hmm. and waiting to see how stories are going to come out, and that's how we operate. And the only thing that I like to point out is that those stories are not about life; they're life. They're what we are.
They are also the foundation of something called scenario planning, right?
That's quite true, yes.
Tell me about scenario planning. It sounds fascinating.
Well, scenario planning or thinking, some people call it a form of conversation, is a way of dealing with a place where we find ourselves, we, the human species, find ourselves these days, which is increasingly recognizing something that, of course, you inevitably do recognize when you see that the world has changed a lot. You kind of suspect it's going to continue to. And you know that you have to think about the future. You have to think about the future if you're a manager of a business. You have to think about the future if you're in any technological field. You have to think about the future if you're concerned about public issues. How do you do that? You cannot function without some sort of a sense of what's going to happen out front. But at the same time, you know now that nobody can foretell the future. Who knew that these big, clunky, stupid computers were going to turn it into little things that were
run
just
our
all
lives.
Run our lives and change our lives and make us, again, a different kind of being than we had been before. And we have, I suspect, still only begun to see a little bit of that. Well, when you know that things have changed that much and are changing that much, you need to kind of suspect that they're going to change. But you can't say exactly how because it's full of surprises. The only way one of the best kind of flexible ways that we have found to deal with that is to construct multiple stories. They're kind of good stories that are responsible, plausible, internally consistent accounts of where things may go from here in a particular industry, in the world, whatever. And to use those, and most of the kind of scenario technology came out of business, to use them for planning, so that if you're coming up with a particular division in a business comes up with a plan of what it wants to do, and if the corporation has developed a set of scenarios, then the manager of that division might be expected to just kind of respond to questions, well, if this happens, then what happens to what you're talking about? So that he kind of tests it against three or four or five multiple realities. And that's explicitly changing from the days when there used to be what they called the official reality, which was just kind of a set of expectations about what the business was going to be doing. And so it turns out to be a pretty good way, not an infallible way, but one way of kind of dealing with where we are.
This sounds like a very strong analogy for an evolutionary process. You create these universes and you test them against the best resource that you can, which is the people that have to inhabit those, and you essentially create a fitness domain in which those ideas stand or fall, and you try to select the best one. That's an analogy, though. Mm-hmm. We started out talking about evolution in a more technical sense, and I still can't quite close that gap. Mm-hmm. Help me.
I'm not quite following you.
Evolution is, we tend to think of it as a biological process, mm-hmm. and I'm saying, I'm not even sure about that, but that's what you're saying, is that it is now applicable in ways that go beyond biology.
That's quite correct.
It is essentially a social evolution or a cultural evolution. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Okay. We know about the genomic process.
What we're just beginning to recognize, now it's been recognized kind of classically by evolutionary biologists for several decades now, that when human beings developed the capacity for speech and then for writing, that they were, in a sense, opening up what some of the old-timers call a new path of evolutionary development. They call it cultural DNA. So we could communicate information, so to speak, not only genetically, but symbolically.
These are what some people call memes.
Well, now that's what some people now call memes, yes.
Okay. They had a name.
Okay. Before they had a name.
But I just want to make sure
we are in the same boat, yes.
Okay.
So in that sense, you could kind of look at cultural evolution as something that came out of genetic evolution, so to speak, which it did. We also know that as soon as early human beings developed culture, that is, developed the ability to speak, that the ability to use culture became so adaptive that the human brain selected for brains that could speak good and process language. But now we're seeing yet another way, a kind of a loop where cultural evolution is changing biological evolution, which is in all the ways that we are capable of intervening in the breeding of other species and in the environments to which other species adapt. And as we move into the era of genomics and increasing kinds of biological evolution, what that means is that cultural evolution turns around and transforms biological evolution.
And they are then inseparable.
Absolutely inseparable, yes.
See, this is part of that brain stretching thing. This is not intuitively obvious to ordinary folks.
It may not be intuitively obvious, but it's not too hard to, as I said earlier, to recognize that when something happens, like, for example, transplantation of organs, that something pretty big in the evolutionary sense has taken place, and that it's a result of information. It is a result of information.
Bill?
Go ahead.
You talked about scenario planning, which, if I remember correctly from your book, started in the military, then you talked about it in business, and now it is being applied, and you are among those applying it, to public policy, to political processes. It can go both directions, can't it? That it is growing in its applicability to use stories and do it in a evolutionary fashion, but it's also something I can do, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I do it all the time, maybe we all do, that you do a bunch of stories and you figure out which one you like best and try to move in that direction.
Yeah.
Is that the flow?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody can do that. A year or so ago, I was up in Canada talking about this kind of stuff to a group of people that had come together from different regions of the country. And there was a young woman from way up north there in one of those places.
Yellowknife.
Someplace like that.
Cold.
She came from one of the Native American tribes and had come down. She was a law student. So she responded pretty strongly when I started talking about people commuting between different cultures and stuff like that. And she wanted to talk some more, and we talked for hours. But one of the things she was particularly interested in, since this happened to be a group that was doing some work on scenarios of Canada, was whether she might be able to figure out some way to go back to her people in way up there in the north, who have a wonderful culture of storytelling, and just see if maybe a way they could maybe deal with some of the stuff they were going through would be to play around with telling stories about the future.
Powerful tradition from the past that could be very powerful.
Yeah.
Now, well, isn't that sort of what you're talking about, is the ability to pick and choose and to rethink it and do it in a different way?
There's also, though, a synthetic quality to it, in the positive sense of synthetic, and pulling disparate elements together, which I think is part of why this is so important.
Oh, you don't mean like plastic?
No.
Yeah. You mean really putting new pieces together to be...
synthetic as opposed to analytic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing about the scenario process, like some kinds of therapies, as a matter of fact, is the role-playing kind of techniques, is that they give you a safe space in which to imagine and to tell stories about the future in a kind of more flexible way than you probably would ordinarily. I know it has that kind of liberating effect for people in businesses frequently.
It also, I think, a little bit I've seen, it also allows people, instead of standing on the outside projecting, you know, what's going to happen, or trying to write what are essentially impersonal equations to describe the world, which in a lot of cases simply does not work, it allows them to engage and bring the best of their abilities. Now, they still may not be right,
mm-hmm.
but at least they are actively involved in the process, and you get, it would seem, more reliable information that way.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
Does that describe how you see scenario planning working?
Yeah. It's funny, I don't think I had consciously made the connection until just now between scenario planning. I used to do a lot of work in various forms of group psychotherapy, in particularly psychodrama and role-playing. And what people would commonly do in those contexts would be to create a situation where somebody is dealing with, you know, what am I going to do with my job, or what am I going to do with my wife? And you would kind of identify the alternatives. And then you would say, okay, this is not reality. This is not it, and this does not mean you're going to do this in reality. Try this on.
Yeah.
And then try that on.
Yeah.
And then try something else on. And don't even make a decision now. Just kind of process that for a while. But it creates that little bit of a safe space in which somebody is enabled to experiment with his thoughts and feelings and different alternatives.
This is Walter Truitt Anderson. Bill Russell and I are with him. We are in San Francisco. We're going to be back in just a moment. Please do be with us.